International.
Ici Radio-Canada. This is Canada.
This is Radio Nederland, the Dutch World Broadcasting System in Hilversum, Holland.
You're tuned to Swiss Radio International in Bern.
This is Free China as a presentation of the Voice of Free China, the international service of the Broadcasting Corporation of China.
This is Radio Havana, Cuba.
Broadcasting from Cuba, free territory in the Americas.
This is Radio South Africa.
This is Yugoslavia Radio Belgrade calling.
This is Israel broadcasting from Jerusalem.
This is Radio Pyongyang of the Democratic People's Republic of Korea.
This is the General Overseas Service of the BBC.
Hello, I'm Keith Powell, and welcome to Media Network Plus from PCJ Radio International. Today we're putting the spotlight on Chernobyl, because this week marked the 30th anniversary of one of the worst nuclear disasters ever. Now, some people might say, well, what about Fukushima? Well, Fukushima was not caused by the earthquake, but rather the tsunami. What happened at Chernobyl wasn't caused by Mother Nature, but rather a design flaw in the Chernobyl nuclear power plant. Now, the whole area has been cordoned off since then. Everybody was moved out of the area. But there are some people, however, who have returned. Of course, the population is a lot smaller than the thousands who were living there at the time. The area still does have a lot of hotspots and is very popular with tourists who are going to Ukraine. If you enter the exclusion zone, you do have to have a Geiger counter with you to make sure that you're not exposed too long to the deadly radiation. 30 years ago, Jonathan Marks, when he was doing the Media Network program on Radio Nederland, had this to say, and this was just after the nuclear disaster.
The Soviet government reports an accident at the Chernobyl nuclear power plant in the Ukraine, resulting in damage to one of the plant's nuclear reactors. Measures are being taken to deal with the aftermath of the accident and to help those affected.
Radio Kiev, much closer to the stricken reactor site, said exactly the same thing on Monday. Only during Tuesday afternoon did the event start to get described as a disaster. Bearing in mind that the reactor accident happened on Saturday, one wonders if radiation had not been detected in Sweden and Finland, whether the Soviet media would have reported the problem at all. As news of the disaster became apparent, we turned to the amateur radio bands, namely 20 and 40 metres, to see whether ham radio might be used for emergency calls. Amateur radio operators in the Ukraine use call signs to identify themselves, beginning with UB5, UT5, UY5, or UZ5. We checked with the Dutch National Amateur Radio Society and the Radio Society of Great Britain to find out whether any emergency calls from the stricken area have been received. Two listeners in Western Europe, one in Denmark, the other here in Holland, claim to have heard Soviet amateurs at different times describing the disaster. But these conversations haven't been heard by anyone else. Signals from amateurs in the Ukraine are being well heard at the moment, but the topics of conversation are limited to the usual amateur radio jargon. It's very unusual for it to be anything else. Pat Gowan is the European coordinator for the amateur radio satellite organisation AMSAT and regularly in touch with Soviet amateurs. As Pat's also involved in a number of propagation experiments, we asked him whether the Soviet nuclear disaster could affect the ionosphere and therefore radio conditions.
I wouldn't have thought it would have gone up as far as the ionosphere. It would take an enormous heat plume to take it up even to about 30 or 40 miles, Jonathan. Certainly, if the radiation level is very, very high indeed, you could certainly get ionization and local high noise levels, but I can't see a plume going up to, 300 kilometres. Well, we thought that we could hear higher noise level and effects following some of the big H tests, which they had at Bikini Atoll and things like this. Mm-hmm. But probably these were due to magnetic disturbances and the sort of long-term effects of the EMP. Enormous quantities of earth and water vapour were chucked up very high mm-hmm. with the heat. But I don't think you would have had this. It's a scale, nothing like this.
No.
I think you could almost definitely say there would be no effects, Jonathan.
That was a clip from Media Network 30 years ago when Jonathan Marks reported on Media Network what happened at the Chernobyl nuclear power plant. Well, this past week, many international broadcasters have been dedicating special programs to what happened 30 years ago. This is one from the BBC World Service. Talks about how people found out about it and the media coverage and the media secrecy surrounding it and how it all played out. It's produced and presented by Dina Newman.
Today, we're going back to the worst nuclear accident in history, to the 26th of April, 1986, when a reactor exploded at a nuclear power station in Chernobyl in Soviet Ukraine.
Scientists in Sweden are trying to locate the source of a sharp increase in the level of radioactivity in the atmosphere. Similar levels.
The first news of nuclear contamination in Northern Europe came from Sweden.
A Swedish nuclear power station was closed down earlier today, but the authorities in Stockholm say they now believe the station was not the cause of any leak.
3 days later, the build-up of evidence from neighboring countries forced Moscow to disclose the accident.
The Soviet government reports an accident at the Chernobyl nuclear power plant in the Ukraine. Measures are being taken to deal with the aftermath of the accident and to help those affected. According to the TASS news agency, this was the first such accident in the Soviet Union. There have been many disasters involving nuclear power plants abroad.
The first information appeared several days after disaster in the main Soviet newspaper, and it was a small announcement, like 2 by 2 inches.
Sergei Mirny was a 27-year-old civil chemical engineer from the Ukrainian city of Kharkov. Sergei, like many other graduates, had undergone military training and was an expert in chemical, biological and nuclear monitoring. Yet, despite his training, even he was not alarmed by the news.
Nobody was worried at all, because at that time nuclear energy was considered as absolutely safe. So, you know, it was just regarded by everyone as a, you know, ordinary industrial accident, which sometimes happens.
31 people died in the immediate aftermath of the explosion. Within hours, nuclear radiation in the nearest town of Pripyat reached life-threatening levels. Yet the town's 40,000 residents knew nothing apart from that there had been a fire at the nuclear plant. 36 hours passed before authorities evacuated the town. It took another week to evacuate the next 30,000 people from Chernobyl, a town just 7 kilometers away from the plant, and dozens of nearby villages. Hundreds of those evacuated died in the next 3 months. Some of these lives could have been saved by prompt measures and information on how to deal with nuclear contamination, but the authorities were tight-lipped, allowing only a small item on the country's main news program.
It was confusing because we couldn't see anything. We only had the news report from the Soviet government, which was 3 lines on the news program Vremya.
Jackie Goff, a British student, was studying in the Ukrainian capital Kiev, only 100 kilometers away from Chernobyl.
They really should have thought of the Soviet people. They were left thinking things were fine. You would if you only heard 3 lines on a news program, which was the third item in order of importance. And whilst I was there, life was going on as normal.
But the winds blew the plume of radioactivity away from Kiev to northern Ukraine and neighbouring Belarus, where in the months to come, thousands of people got thyroid cancer. Meanwhile, in the 10-kilometre area around the plant, evacuation, when it finally started, was ruthless. Residents were not allowed to take anything with them, not even their pets or children's toys. In order not to spread panic, people were told they would come back in 3 days. Most never saw their homes again. In May 1986, the reactor was still on fire, emitting radioactive smoke into the atmosphere and leaking radioactive particles into its foundations. However, on the 14th of May, the Soviet leader Mikhail Gorbachev felt it was necessary to reassure the public.
Благодаря принятым эффективным мерам, Thanks to effective measures, the worst is behind us, and the gravest consequences have been averted.
Many Soviet people believed their leader, but when the chemical engineer Sergei Mirny was called up to the disaster zone in the middle of July, more than 2 months after the explosion, the Soviet military cleanup operation was still in full swing.
Everything was huge. Everything was epic. Huge nuclear power plant, a huge burst open exploded unit, a huge mitigation vehicle, many of them military vehicle, which were designed to act in after atomic bombardment in World War III.
The soil around the nuclear plant was being dug up, thrown into ditches and covered with concrete. Helicopters were spraying the area to stop radioactive dust from rising into the air. Soldiers went around residential neighborhoods washing radioactive dust from pavements and walls. Hunting units shot all cats and dogs so that pets did not contaminate the humans working in the exclusion zone.
Tens of thousands of people teeming everywhere. In all kinds of uniforms and fatigues, you know, nobody in a normal civilian wear.
The scale of the nuclear contamination turned out to be more serious than previously thought. As the commander of a monitoring unit, Sergei measured and reported radiation levels in the 30-kilometer exclusion zone. Based on Sergei's data, the authorities ordered more villages to evacuate.
You cannot imagine this painful feeling when you see the live village and you know that tomorrow they will be told, go out of here.
Once villagers left, their homes were demolished and the rubble was buried.
And you can imagine, you know, this crying and suffering and pain, and you know it and you can do nothing about it. You cannot help these people.
Evacuation was particularly hard for the tens of thousands of peasants who had lived in the area for generations and who ended up in concrete apartment blocks in nearby towns, a totally alien environment for them.
I was struck by the stories of the people, former residents of this area, who illegally, using, guerrilla routes from the World War II, returned to their native places in order to take care of their vegetable garden, you know, to catch some fish, you know, to look after the house, you know, and it was very, very powerful. And they told me about their suffering when they were being evicted and how they lived in somebody else's house for unknown and undefined period. And it pained me a lot. It still pains me, you know, and that is why, as an expert in mitigation of radiation accident, I am always attentive to the needs of the local people, you know. And I suggest a policy of very selective eviction.
The 30-kilometer exclusion zone around Chernobyl is still in place. Sergei, who now conducts tours around the exclusion zone, believes the wild, overgrown area has something to teach us about nuclear energy and about nature.
Technically and ecologically, the mitigation was rather efficient. And so I realized it's necessary to start using the zone in a positive way and to change its symbolic meaning. More than 15 years ago, I suggested to convert the zone into the Chernobyl National Park.
Plans to create a nature reserve in the exclusion zone are still under discussion. But the disaster in Chernobyl has changed the nuclear industry. It has become more transparent and accountable as a result.
Dina Newman from the BBC program Outlook, reporting on Chernobyl 30 years later. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Media Network Plus, coming to you from PCJ Radio International.
The Spectrum Monitor is a monthly electronic magazine covering shortwave, amateur radio, scanning, satellites, Wi-Fi, and vintage radio, which is available for any device capable of opening a PDF file.
Charlie 1 0 5, which is PD 2 2 2 0 0.
Space 220, Corey 105.
The Spectrum Monitor also covers amateur radio satellites, maritime and military monitoring on shortwave, reviews of receivers, scanners, and software used for shortwave, and more. Annual subscriptions for 12 issues is only $24, with individual monthly issues available for $3 each. If you're already a subscriber, you can renew your subscription by clicking on the Sign Up for 2015 button. MasterCard, Visa, Discover, and PayPal are accepted. For more details, visit our website at www.thespectrummonitor.com.
Hi, my name's Colin Newell, and I'm the editor and creator of DXR.ca. Since the mid-90s, DXR.ca has been the go-to website for timely resources for the DXR, SWL, and broadcast listener. If you're looking for unbiased reviews of the most modern receivers and antennas, or are interested in participating in some of the more lively online forums all about radio, then come on by. DXR.ca, a world band radio website.
Well, if you are a regular listener to the program, you may have heard us talk about some stations that were going off the air, or the possibility of stations going off the air. Well, that would include Radio Belarus, that is saying bye-bye, and also the possibility that All India Radio, External Service, and Radio Cairo will disappear. So we have these three stations, two of which may disappear, and one of them that will be or already has disappeared. So now we're going to talk about another shortwave station. And no, it's actually the opposite of those three. In fact, it's a new shortwave station that will begin in South Sudan. It's going to be operated by iMedia. iMedia, the station is going to be called Radio Tamazuja. And it will broadcast on shortwave. Now, the only information that we have so far is, well, the time and frequencies to the station. The station will be on the air from 6:30 UTC to 7:30 UTC each morning on 11650 kHz and 9600 kHz. That's from 6:30 to 7:30 GMT on 11650 kHz and 9600 kHz, and on 15150 and 15550, 15150 and 15550. In the evenings, that is, from 17:30 to 18:30. Now, if any of you have managed to pick up this broadcast, do let us know, so we can actually play a clip on the program. Now, I did check out those frequencies here in Taiwan, but unfortunately, very often, frequencies meant for Africa are very difficult to pick up here. There's also another radio station, iRadio, and they're going to be on the air from 7 to 8 hours UTC each morning on 11730 kHz in the 25-meter band and 17730 kHz in the 17-meter band in the evenings from 9 to 20 hours UTC. Now, as I mentioned, if you did have a chance to hear these two broadcasts, let us know and do send along a clip. As I said, I've tried them here in Taiwan, but it just wasn't possible at all. All right, we now go to Vanuatu. Now, the last time we reported on Vanuatu was when we were joined on the program by Bruce Hill. This was right after they were hit by a devastating cyclone, which devastated the whole nation. Not just the main island, but also the other islands that make up the island nation of Vanuatu in the Pacific. Now, during that cyclone, just after that cyclone, Radio Australia's Pacific Beat program was providing special programming on the situation. And as we heard, even some international broadcasters like the BBC World Service increased their output during that period of time. Now, when Bruce Hill joined us on the program, he talked about the devastation caused to its communication system. But the thing is, communications in Vanuatu have been suffering for quite some time, especially Radio Vanuatu. Now, it's hoped that soon they will be able to return to the standard it once had and can be heard everywhere across the island of Vanuatu. Years of neglect and political interference have resulted in the deterioration of transmission to the outer islands, but there's now a new push to get a nationwide coverage again. As Bridget Tenecliffe reports, shortwave radio is being seen as an important option for the Pacific.
The need to get early warnings to people, especially in more remote areas, has been highlighted by the increased frequency of severe tropical cyclones. The government recently replaced the Vanuatu Broadcasting and Television Corporation Board following concerns over the lack of the public broadcaster's ability to reach the outer islands. An MP for Tana, Tom Luaniwan, says they don't get clear reception on Tana and it's unreliable.
We depend much of the radio for information because we are now living in the climate change and, you know, cyclones and tsunamis and, you know.
The board's new chair, Jonetti Geraghty, says nationwide coverage has to be implemented by July the 1st under the government's 100-day plan. He says they are on track to achieve that, but says part of the problem is people have been buying cheap radios that are not compatible. He says out of habit, people have also become more accustomed to tuning into the island's main FM station.
Because they have lost coverage with Radio Vanuatu for so long, they have now have difficulties in tuning in to our frequency system. And that is what we are doing now, trying to promote all these frequencies to the islands to ensure that everyone knows which type of frequency they should be tuning in.
New Zealand radio transmission engineer Steve White has made several trips to Vanuatu and other Pacific countries to help set up transmission equipment. He says the big advantage of shortwave radio is that receivers are extremely cheap to buy. Mr. White says the other benefit is that the transmission is capable of covering enormous distances.
From Port Vila, you can cover the entire country of Vanuatu, which spans something like 1,100 kilometres in a roughly north-south direction. That can't be achieved by any other transmission mode.
Jonetti Geraghty says despite increases in government funding to the corporation over the years, changes in government and political interference have been disruptive.
Politicians come as members of parliament and then they use that opportunity to turn out funds from the institution and make it very difficult for institutions to have enough or appropriate funds to maintain its transmission system.
Jonetti Geraghty says Radio Vanuatu's financial difficulties have been heightened by the emergence of several other FM stations who are all competing for advertising dollars. The former mayor of Luganville, Morris Emboy, says the quality of information being broadcast is also critical. Early this month, there were claims in northern parts of Vanuatu that the public broadcaster did not broadcast warnings about the approach of Cyclone Zena. Morris Emboy says information needs to be accurate, timely and regular.
The authority concerned, the media also, should take more responsibility into communicating with regards to disaster or such information. To inform people, communicate with people, the tracking of the depression is whereabouts.
This is Bridget Tunnicliffe.
And we are, by the way, working on having somebody from Radio Vanuatu come on the program to give us some more details. You're listening to Media Network Plus, shuffling some papers, coming to you from PCJ Radio International.
The British DX Club is one of the world's leading DX clubs, with hundreds of members both in the UK and around the globe. BDXE produce a comprehensive monthly magazine called Communication, covering all aspects of the DXing hobby. The BDXE Audio Circle is also available and is a monthly program of DX catches and general chat about radio. For more information, please write to the British DX Club, 10 Hemdene Hill, Caversham, Reading, RG4, 7SB in the United Kingdom, or visit the website at www.bdxc.org.uk. That's www.bdxc.org.uk.
Well, it's all coming towards the end of the program, and anybody that listens to it on a regular basis know that we always do one thing 99.9% of the time at the end, and that's take a look at propagation, what's been happening, and what we can expect. Here's our propagation editor, Glenn Hauser.
Keith from IPS in Australia, the global HF propagation forecast through April 30th.
normal to fair at low latitudes, fair to normal at middle and high latitudes. From Space Weather South Africa through April 29th, magnetic conditions quiet until unsettled on the 29th, shortwave fadeouts unlikely, MUF unstable. From Met Office UK through May 1st, solar activity very low or low, geomagnetic activity in a lull until a risk of a planetary KNX of 5 and G1 storms on April 30th. From FK Yanda in Prague, the geomagnetic field will be quiet on May 7th, 12th, 16th, 17th, and 18th. Mostly quiet on May 1st, 3rd, 6th, 13th, and 15th. Quiet to unsettled May 2nd, 4th, and 8th. Quiet to active April 29th, May 9th, 11th, and 14th. Active to disturbed on April 30th, May 5th, and 10th. From SWPC in Boulder, an isolated minor storm period is possible on April 30th with A and K indices of 18 and 5. A greater peak around May 10th with A's and K's of 25 and 5. Lowest readings of 5 and 2 on May 2nd, 3rd and 5th to 8th. Solar flux rising from 80 on April 28th to a peak of 100 on May 11th. William Hepburn's VHF UHF DX maps show extreme tropospheric ducting off the Texas Gulf Coast April 29th and 30th, the southwest coast of Mexico May 2nd and 3rd, and at least through May 3rd, along the coasts of Angola and Namibia, around the Bay of Bengal through May 3rd, and extremely extreme between Oman and India.
Thanks a lot, Glenn. And by the way, Glenn Hauser, in case you didn't know this, if you are a follower of communications and radio, you probably do. But in case you didn't, he also has a program called World of Radio that gives a lot of fascinating information about what's been happening on the shortwave and radio dials. And it's an interesting program because it's most of it is made up of submissions from listeners. So do go and check it out, World of Radio with Glenn Hauser. Anyway, with that, we've come to the end of the program. If you want to contact us to let us know what you think, our email address is mnp@pcjmedia.com. That's mnp@pcjmedia.com. You can listen to this edition again or even past editions by visiting our website. All the shows are linked, the most recent ones, and then you'll find one link which will bring you to a page that has all the programs going back to 2009. And the URL is pcjmedia.com. On behalf of the whole team, I'm Keith Powell, wishing you all saying 73 and 88 to the ladies.